Okay, welcome to this session on functions in the communication server in ZOS V1R8. We're going to go through or give you a technical overview of the functions in that release. And if you turn to page 3 in the PDF file, I'll just give you a short overview over the agenda that we're going to go through here. We'll start with a discussion of the Sysplex enhancements that are in the communication server in release 8. We will continue with a discussion of the security functions, IP version 6. We will talk a little bit about the enhanced Enterprise Extender and SNA items in this release. There are a number of enhancements to both FTP and Telnet. And finally, we have a little bucket of various smaller items we will go through with you that are also part of the communication server in release 8. If we turn to page 5 as the first Sysplex related item in this release, I'll start with a little discussion of what issue it is we are addressing with this enhancement. And it's best illustrated through an example based on a WebSphere application server running on ZOS. The enhancement is actually not limited to such an application server environment. It will be of benefit or advantage for any scenario where you have both client and server running in the ZOS Sysplex environment. But for illustration, let's look upon this chart on page 5, where you have two LPaaS, and on each of those LPaaS you have a WebSphere application server instance and an instance of some form of an enterprise information system. That would either be KIX transaction gateway if it were KIX you connected to, it would be IMS connect if it were IMS, or it would be the DB2 DDF address space in this scenario for DB2 access. New connections will come into the web application server, and assuming in this example here we're using an external load balancer that will get its advice from the ZOS load balancing advisor, the load balancer will choose which LPAR the initial HTTP connection will go to. And we will come into, for example, this scenario, we choose LPAR 1, so we have a connection with web application server in LPAR 1. When WebSphere application server runs your Java application, and that Java application uses one of the connectors or J2C connectors to communicate with the backend system, that connection to the enterprise information system may either be used what we call local connectors or remote connectors. The local connectors are cross-memory service based and are generally characterized by being fast, and in some scenarios also supporting additional functions as compared to the remote connectors. The disadvantage of using local connectors is one of availability, because if the enterprise information system on LPAR 1 is not available, there is no mechanisms within the local connectors that will recognize that an instance is available on the other LPAR and just switch over to that other LPAR. If one uses remote connectors instead of local connectors, the actual connection is going to be a TCP connection. And in that scenario, one can use availability functions such as Sysplex Distributor, where WebSphere application server will connect to a distributed dynamic VIPER address that represents the two instances of the enterprise information system in this example here. However, if one does that, there will be scenarios where the routing path will not be optimal. Let's take an example and say that the distributed dynamic VIPER address that represents the enterprise information system is currently owned by LPAR 2. Then all connection requests that goes from web application and so on LPAR 1 to such an EIS instance will flow across the dynamic XF connectivity to LPAR 2. And Sysplex Distributor may over there then determine that the connection should go to the EIS instance on LPAR 1 and then send the connection back to LPAR 1 again. Now all inbound data from then on flowing on that connection from web application server to the EIS system will now flow back and forth across or between those two LPARs in order to get there. Outbound data from the EIS system will flow directly back to web application server. there is currently no mechanism where a Sysplex distributor could say, well, I really want to use a local copy. It might as well have used the copy over on LPAR 2, even though the copy on LPAR 1 might have had sufficient capacity at that point in time. But if there were better capacity or better performance on LPAR 2, Sysplex distributor would basically listen to workload manager and send the connection over to the LPAR 2 system, which in some scenarios might actually end up in again in an inefficient routing topology. So what we're doing in ZOS v1.0.8, if you move to page 6, is we implement support for what we call optimized local processing in Sysplex distributor. And the objective of that optimized local processing is to allow Sysplex distributor to know that a connection is coming from a program running on an LPAR, and that there is an instance of the next tier on that LPAR, and it will then favor that copy on that LPAR if it is available and is healthy and performing acceptably at that point in time. You decide to what level Sysplex distributor will favor the local copy, and the scale is basically from one saying you will always use a local copy if it is up and running and it is healthy from a TCP/IP perspective and will not listen to workload manager input at all. And the other endpoint of that scale is you say you will always listen to workload manager and basically work the way it used to work, and basically workload manager input that will determine which instance you will go to. It's important to emphasize that if you use the first option, if that local instance is not available, we will go to an instance on the other LPAR. So from an availability point of view, you're not losing any type of capabilities using these functions here. There are a lot of internal changes in along with this function here. One change is that if you just look at this example here between LPAR 1 and LPAR 2, when web application server connects to the enterprise information system, and as before, the distributed dynamic VIPER address is owned by LPAR 2, we no longer need to actually send the connection request over to LPAR 2. There is enough distributed Sysplex distributor logic in all the LPARs to know that this is an optimized local distributed dynamic VIPER address, and there is a copy on our own LPAR. So we actually will do no cross LPAR flows at all, not even for the connections set up in this environment. In addition to these enhancements, because we now know that we have a so-called local connection, we actually do now know in this scenario here that both the client part and the server part of that connection is on a single LPAR. We can use some optimized internal processing within TCP/IP that we generally refer to as fast direct local sockets that bypass a lot of the overhead we otherwise would have to go through in order to pass packets over to other LPARs or to other IP nodes. That all adds up to a considerable performance improvement if one actually has such a topology where both client and server programs are located on ZOS and you use Sysplex distributor between such applications. This little example on page 7 where we prior to v1.0.8, if we had the client and the server on the left LPAR and the distributed dynamic VIPER address VIPER on the right LPAR, everything would go over to the other LPAR and then come back to the first LPAR again, whereas we, with the optimized local processing in v1.0.8, will stay local on the original LPAR all the time. And depending a little bit on the type of workload, that has a significant impact both on throughput and on CPU consumption per transaction. It's kind of obvious that if you were doing inbound file transfer workload from the client to the server, well, before v1.0.8, all those packets would have to cross the LPAR boundaries two times in order to get to the server, whereas we, with optimized local processing, just pass the data from the client to the server internally in the LPAR, which obviously is going to go significantly faster than it did earlier. So there are significant performance benefits if one has this type of topology. Okay, moving to page 8. In v1.0.8, we also extend the choices you have for how to determine which source IP address to use when outbound connections are made from a ZOS system. There's been a long range of functions being added over time. And one of the latest were the source IP address section within the TCP/IP profile. Prior to V1R8, you could create rules within the source IP section that were based on job names. And basically have a job name there and say, if that job name creates an outbound connection, use this source IP address. There were examples where that job name based selection did not work very well. And one example was, for example, was if you had a long running address space that needed to connect to different business partners. Well, from a job name perspective, that would be a single entity, and the source IP rules would only give you one choice of a source IP address, where you really needed two different choices based on which business partner you connected to. So V1R8, we add an extension to the source IP section that allows you to specify source IP rules based on the destination IP address you are connecting to. So in this example on page 8, if that batch job connects to an IP address in the 10.1.1 subnet, we will use one source IP address. If you connect to an IP address in the 10.1.2 subnet, we will use another source IP address, basically giving you more flexibility in that type of environments. There's one thing you need to be aware of in ZOS V1R8, and that is the source IP address you configure there cannot be a distributed dynamic VIP address. It can be an interface IP address, a static VIP or dynamic VIP, but it cannot be a distributed dynamic VIP address. That is a restriction in ZOS V1R8. If you move to page 9, just an overview of some functions we have been adding for a number of years, which we refer to as Sysplex Autonomics. And the general objective of Sysplex Autonomics is to add capability to TCP/IP to be able to react to and recover from certain error conditions before your end users, or for that matter, before your operators detect that something is wrong. So it's basically sensors built into TCP/IP that will monitor a whole range of different conditions. And if a TCP/IP stack that currently is having an important role in your Sysplex determines that it's currently has and that it currently has an issue of some sort, you then have configuration options that can instruct it to pull itself out of the Sysplex and allow other TCP/IP stacks within the Sysplex to take over dynamic VIPA addresses and Sysplex distributor responsibilities and things like that. Basically initiate the Sysplex IP recovery functions without necessarily having any operators to detect and start those functions. We've implemented those over a couple of years, and they include things like monitoring for dependent functions, OMP route up and running, VTime up and running, XF connectivities work, connectivity working, storage not being constrained, and things like that. In this release on page 10, we add one additional condition to these monitoring points we have in the TCP/IP environment. And that has to do with network interfaces becoming unavailable. You know, look at a little example here on page 10. You have Sysplex distributor over on the right-hand side and these two LPARs. And let's just assume that that LPAR only has a single network interface to the downstream network. If that network interface fails, all the monitoring we had put in place in the previous releases would not detect that as a situation that should be recovered, because nothing really is wrong according to the monitors that we had implemented early on. OMP route is running, VTime is running, dynamic XF is working, but in this specific scenario, no clients can actually connect to that Sysplex distributor. So all connections to that distributor dynamic VIP address will be lost in this environment here. So what we add in this release is a mechanism for you to specify selected network interfaces to be monitored for availability, and if they are unavailable, then initiate recovery functions, basically pulling that TCP/IP stack out of the Sysplex. Now the monitoring extends to two levels. It includes monitoring of the actual network interface, for example an OSA adapter, but it also extends to the first hop router in the downstream network. If OMP route determines that it no longer can communicate with a router over that network interface, that network interface will no longer be considered an available interface. That is under configuration control if you want that level, but it is recommended to extend it to that level also. Another main function we add in release 8 has to do with environments where a ZOS sysplex has connectivity to different networks. And there are really two examples of such topologies. One is an example where a ZOS sysplex connects to both, for example, an intranet and maybe some form of internet connectivity, typically through some kind of a demilitarized zone. The way customers would normally do that would be to have a dedicated LPaaS for internet or DMZ, or having multiple IP stacks on the individual LPaaS, where one stack was then connected to the internet and the other stack to the demilitarized zone. Another example of similar type of topologies would be if you were a service provider that provided services to different customers within your environment, but you were running all of those within a single ZOS sysplex. There are scenarios where you still might want to be able to separate the network connectivity between those different customers, or for those different customers. Now, with the current IP sysplex functions, when you enable IP sysplex, the scope of the IP sysplex is the ZOS sysplex, so you cannot limit it to only a certain set of TCP/IP stacks within the sysplex. And the only way one could actually deal with an environment like the one here on page 11 would be to only enable sysplex functions in the intranet IP stacks and, for example, not on the DMZ IP stacks. So in a sense, limit the use of IP sysplex functions to only a subset of the TCP/IP stacks one had within a ZOS sysplex environment. So what we're doing in release 8, if you move to page 12, is we allow you to define what we call a networking subplex, which is really a subset of network TCP/IP and or VTAM functions within a ZOS sysplex environment. If you look at this example here with five LPaaS, you have VTAM in LPaaS 1 and LPaaS 2 making up one SNA subplex, and you have VTAM in the other three LPaaS making up another SNA subplex. From an SNA perspective, the subplex identifies or defines the boundaries of XCF connectivity, and it also defines the boundaries for generic resources and MNPS sessions in these type of environments. For TCP/IP, since it's possible to start multiple IP stacks on an LPaaS, there is support for having multiple stacks in an LPaaS connected to different subplexes. So if you look at, for example, LPaaS number 4 on this chart here, you have three different IP stacks, IP1, IP2, and IP3, and each of these three IP stacks are members of different IP subplexes. From an IP perspective, the subplex defines the scope of dynamic XCF connectivity, and it defines the scope in which dynamic VIPER addresses can move and are visible among the different IP stacks. So only the TCP/IP stacks in the intranet IP subplex would have knowledge of dynamic VIPER addresses on LPaaS 3, 4, and 5 within that subplex. They would have no knowledge of the dynamic VIPERs, for example, in the development IP subplex in that type of scenario here. Now, in order to handle dynamic XCF connectivity that you have configured to use hypersockets, if the partner TCP/IP stacks are on the same mainframe hardware, there is a single chip ID you designate for such purpose. And in a scenario like this, if for example, all five LPaaS were on a single System Z hardware box, you really had four separate dynamic XCF networks that have no knowledge of each other's. So the way to handle that for hypersockets dynamic XCF support is to implement support for VLAN IDs on hypersockets. So one of the configuration options in a scenario like this would be for Dynamic XF to specify which VLAN ID on this shared, if you will, hypersockets network does this subplex use for its Dynamic XF connectivity. That VLAN ID support for hypersockets has also been extended to your manually defined hypersockets device link definitions. So if you would need to use VLANs on hypersockets networks you defined yourself, that support is also available in this release. There's a brief overview on page 13 that just briefly introduces how you will configure these different subplexing configurations. The good news is, if you do not need subplexing, you will change absolutely nothing compared to what you had prior to ZOS v1.R8, because all the defaults make a subplex equal a sysplex in scope. If you do need to exploit subplexing, you will need to identify in both VTAM and or TCP/IP which subplexes the different nodes belong to, and you will have to define maybe multiple instances of some of the coupling facility structures. If you have two VTAM subplexes within the sysplex, they cannot use the same generic resource structures, for example, in the coupling facility, but you need to define unique structures for that purpose. And you will basically derive the names for those structures from your subplex configuration in these examples here. If we turn to page 14, another function in release 8 is a replacement of parts of the functions that were implemented in the early domain name server workload manager solution on ZOS. DNS WLM was the very first attempt that we made on doing load balancing into a ZOS sysplex. A DNS-based load balancing technology is not really attractive today, given the multitude of other technologies that exist for that today. So from that perspective, DNS WLM is really not of any value today. But a side effect of using DNS WLM was that it was possible to dynamically register names in the ZOS name server when certain applications started and or stopped within the sysplex. The names would then be removed from the name server. And that was a useful function that was, in a sense, a side effect of DNS WLM's the way it worked. What we do in v1.R8 is we implement an alternative for you to dynamically register when certain servers start within your ZOS sysplex. This infrastructure will allow you to update a name server and it will use standard dynamic DNS functions to do so. So the name server does no longer have to be on ZOS. It could be on ZOS or it could be any bind 8 or bind 9 name server that supports the standard dynamic DNS update functions. There are some configurations in order to set that this up. You need to specify which server port numbers you want to register in a name server, and obviously also under what names you want that registration to occur. This is built on top of the load balancing advisor that was implemented in one of the previous releases. So it's kind of the load balancing advisor infrastructure is a prerequisite to make this function work. Just briefly on page 15, we shipped at some point in time functions within OSA Express 2 to do TCP segmentation offload, which was a performance enhancement for outbound streaming workload. There were some issues with that microcode initially, and TCP/IP implemented some APARs that allows you to turn segmentation offload on or off within your TCP/IP profile. There was a global config statement called segmentation offload or no segmentation offload. Up until now, it has been recommended that you specify no segmentation offload. It is expected that the microcode updates are going to be in place very soon, so that you should be able to exploit segmentation offload within the near-term future. It has significant CPU savings if you are doing what we call streaming outbound workload, basically means that you are sending large amounts of data out from ZWS. It has no impact if you are receiving large amount of inbound data. A couple of other functions for OSA we will talk just briefly about on page 16. OSA Express 2 virtual MAC addressing has been added when the adapter operates in what is known as QDO layer 3 mode. That's a traditional mode that IP would use the adapter in. It includes the so-called IP assist functions in the OSA microcode. So far, there has always been one hardware medium access control address on the adapter, and that's why you had all these OSA addressing table definitions or dynamic definitions that allowed the microcode to determine where inbound packets should go in terms of which LPAS sharing the adapter was the destination of a certain inbound packet. With this support, you can, per network interface in the different TCP IP stacks and LPAS that share the adapter, specify a virtual MAC address that allows each TCP IP stack to actually have a layer 2 identity on the local area network to which the OSA adapter is attached. It's going to make lots of configurations much simpler. Scenarios today where you cannot use, for example, what we call MAC level forwarders or dispatch mode forwarders for load balancing on the LAN because of shared OSA adapter issues are going away with this type of support here. So it's just going to make the environment look much more like a normal LAN adapter type of environment. Another main function that is being added to OSA Express 2 and TCP IP is a capability to trace LAN traffic at a very low level within the OSA adapter. One of the issues that have come up lately has been that as functions have been offloaded to the OSA adapter, there are certain packets that never make it up into the TCP IP stack. And it's normally within the TCP IP stack that packet trace functions are executed today. One example is address resolution protocol packets. When someone on the LAN sends out an ARP request, well, the OSA adapter microcode will actually receive that and respond to that ARP request with an ARP reply. And that information will never go up into the TCP IP stack. It's basically done down in the OSA adapter. And there are a number of other so-called offload functions that work the same way, which basically means that the packet trace functions on ZOS may not include all the packet, all the activity that actually is going on onto the, you know, on the LAN adapter. This new network traffic analyzer function will capture everything that goes in and out over the LAN adapter in the OSA Express 2 adapter itself. The data will be sent up to a controlling ZOS LPAR, where a TCP IP will take it and write it out through its normal data spaces, and you can process it with the normal IPCS functions as you can also with a standard packet trace function. The trace is controlled in terms of options for the trace, you know, filters, and start and stop through a TCP IP stack that uses the OSA adapter. That stack may either use the adapter for both data traffic and tracing, or it may just do the tracing function, as could be the case in some scenarios. One function that is kind of interesting here is that it is possible for a ZOS LPAR with the right authority set through the hardware management console to request trace of packets in and out of the adapter from all the LPARs that share the adapter. So it is actually possible in LPAR 1 to see packets going in and out over the LAN interface in the OSA Express 2, no matter which of the LPARs that share that adapter those packets come from or go to. So it could be a complete picture of what is actually happening on that OSA LAN adapter. Okay, if you turn to page 18, I'll talk a little bit about security functions in this ZOS Release 8 communication server. And one of the first things I just want to just point your attention to is on page 19. There is something called the Configuration Assistant for ZOS Communication Server, which is currently a tool that you download to and run on Windows. this tool is used to manage or define, if you will, all the different types of networking policies that ZOS can work with. So if you were to use the application transparent transport layer security functions, IP security or IP filtering, intrusion detection services, or quality of services in ZOS v1.0.8, this would be the tool that you would use to define those policies. Up until ZOS v1.0.8, IDS, or intrusion detection services, required you to have an LDAP server in which you had to store those policies. In this release, we've removed that requirement, and the IDS policies will now work like all the other types of policies. You can define them through this GUI, and the GUI will then create a text file that Policy Agent will read and basically install those policies in your ZOS environment. You can also create that text file manually. So if you prefer to type in the definitions using your ISPF editor, you can do so for all the policy types now, including IDS, which you really could not do before. So the main point is here, you really no longer need an LDAP server for IDS policies. There are a couple of updates in terms of what standards we are supporting. One of the standards that have been changed has been the IPsec standard. So IPsec now supports the advanced encryption standard, 128-bit encryption for IPsec workload, and we added support for that here in ZOS v1.0.8. So AES 128-bit encryption is now one of the supported encryption algorithms. As you may remember, in ZOS v1.0.7, if you go to page 21, in ZOS v1.0.7, the communication server re-implemented, if you will, IP filtering and IPsec VPN support. So it is now integrated into the communication server and no longer requires what was called the firewall technologies, or ZOS firewall technologies, which was a relatively old implementation that had existed for many years. The firewall technologies and the new integrated IP security functions coexisted in ZOS v1.0.7, so that you could choose if you wanted to use IP filters and IPsec based on the firewall technologies, or if you wanted to do that based on the new integrated IP security in the communications server. From ZOS v1.0.8, you no longer have the choice of using the firewall technologies component. It is no longer shipped with ZOS. So before you get to ZOS v1.0.8 and implement ZOS v1.0.8, if you are using firewall technologies, you need to have plans in place for migrating that to the integrated IP security component of communication server. There is a tool available, and there is a link at the bottom of this page to that tool. This tool will read your existing firewall technologies, HFS configuration files, and there's a whole series of those stored in your hierarchical file system. The tool will read those, and it will then create a new configuration that will work with the integrated IP security function. It's really a migration tool that will take your old definitions and translate them or migrate them to the new format that is used by the integrated IP security function.
Okay, now moving on to talk about IPv6 a little bit. So if you'll proceed up to FOIL 23, ZOS Communications Server has been on the road to IPv6 for quite some time now, beginning back in version 1 release 4 in 2002. And as we move through time, through v1.0.5 and v1.0.6, we've developed a more fully capable IPv6 platform. And at that point, we're able to achieve the Ready Logo Phase 1 certification. Now, what this basically is proof that we passed a suite of tests, meaning that we are compliant with certain levels of IPv6 RFCs. At this point in time, though, the Phase 2 logo has now been identified, and the primary difference between the Phase 1 and the Phase 2 logo was the addition of IPsec support being mandatory. And so here in v1.0.8, we've added IPsec support for IPv6. Now, you just heard the discussion about how in v1.0.7 we moved from firewall technologies to the integrated IPsec support, and one of the reasons for that transition was it better positioned us for this move. Looking down here on this page, we show a graph showing the consumption of IPv4 addresses in the internet, and clearly we're on a trend here for address depletion, and so The interest in moving to IPv6 grows stronger every day, and we want to discuss this a little bit more in a couple of foils. For now, proceeding to foil 24. This is the details of our IPv6 IPsec support, and you can read out through the bullets there, but it's pretty full featured. We support IP filtering, we support manual and dynamic IPsec tunnels, internet key exchange for dynamic negotiation of tunnels. All of the configuration mechanisms for IPv6 addresses associated with IPsec have also been changed, so that we have policy agent support for IPv6 addresses, GUI support, as well as profile support. So basically, you have everything you put in place now you need to have IPsec running in an IPv6 network with a ZOS communication server. Proceeding to the next foil, foil 25, we just have a little bit of trivia here about current IPv4 address space data. And this is very current, as you'll notice on the foil. It's January 2007. And you can look down through there at the pie charts. We talk about how many addresses are allocated and how they've been allocated and so forth. And as you take a look at this, you'll see that a great deal of the addresses are all reallocated. As a matter of fact, there's only about 19% in the unallocated bucket, plus about almost 10% that are held by regional registries but have not yet been distributed. So clearly we're somewhere around a third at most of the addresses remaining. So if you look at the box on the right and read down through there, what it's saying is that there are current predictions that say somewhere around the year 2011 or 2012, the unallocated pool will be exhausted. At that point, there will be no more IPv4 addresses. So we're at a point now where we have to think about what is the transition plan from there. Proceeding to foil 26, we see a little bit of a data on geographic allocation of IP addresses. And on the left is the allocation of the IPv4 address space. And not too surprisingly, the bulk of the addresses have been assigned to North America. Maybe if there's any surprise, it's how much of that is slanted toward North America, nearly 60%. But IPv6 interest has been much greater in Europe and in the Far East. And if we look at the graph on the right, the IPv6 address space consumption, we see that borne out. Between Asia and Europe, we have over 90% of the addresses allocated. And a matter of fact, if we look at for the little North American slice of the pie, we can barely find it. It's less than 0.5%. So clearly the interest in IPv6 has come from other geographies than North America. But of course, 2011, 2012 growing ever nearer, this does have to change in the future. Proceeding to foil 27, we look at the journey to IPv6 on ZOS communication server. As I stated earlier, this began in V1R4 almost 5 years ago now, in 2002. And we started off with just basic stack support. But as we move through the releases, if you look down through in V1R5 and V1R6, you see us expanding our support for things like Sysplex, Dynamic VIPA, Dynamic Routing support, greater application support. When we get to 1.7, we have additional MIB support. We eventually get hypersocket support. And now here we are, V1R8, available in late 2006, brought in IPsec. So at this point in time, we have a very full-featured IPv6 platform. And if you look at the little box at the bottom of the page there, that has been our objective, is to have an IPv6-ready platform when our customers are ready to move to IPv6. We believe that that time is growing close, and we now have achieved that goal. Okay, on fall 2028, we enter the Enterprise Extender SNA section of V1R8. And proceeding directly to foil 29, we see the first item that we'll talk about in EESNA support for V1R8, and that's the Enterprise Extender Connectivity Test Command. EE has been around a good while now, and it's been in use in our customer environments now for several years. And lately, we've gotten a lot of feedback that it's working very well from a steady state perspective and in many diverse customer shops. The one piece of feedback that we've gotten over and over again over the years is that our customers would like to see better diagnostics, better management, and things along that line. And so if you look across the last few releases, really beginning around V1R5, but picking up a little bit with V1R6, there have been a stream of things done to EE to improve the native diagnostic capabilities, as well as to provide a management capability through an API. V1R8 basically extends that trend by giving you a new form of the EE DIAG command, which was introduced in V1R7. This new form gives us the capability to test an EE connection or test a potential EE connection. Because one of the issues that we've had is a lot of times when people try to define EE, they find it either works great from out of the box, or when they start to bring up a connection and it fails to activate, there's a lot of questions about exactly how do they figure out what's going wrong. Certainly there are VTAM commands that are helpful. Certainly there are TCP/IP tools that are helpful, like ping and traceroute. But there was nothing integrated, and that was a strong customer request here, was an integrated tool that would basically test this from an end-to-end perspective. So here's what you want to find out. You're trying to activate an EE connection to a business partner. You know your VIPA, you know his VIPA, and you would like to know if you can have an EE connection between them. This command will do that. It's issued from VTAM. It will basically verify that there is an EE line available. It'll verify that the host names can be resolved to IP addresses if you're specifying host names. It will then actually test the reachability of the partner address. And the beauty here is that what it's testing with is a true EE flow. It's not simulated. It's not using a different protocol. It's actually utilizing a type of EE logical data link control flow called a probe, which flows through the network and goes all the way to the other side and then comes back. It does it in a manner similar to traceroute so that it can actually gather information along the path to determine what IP hops it's going through so that you can learn not only that you can get there, but how you're getting there. If you have multiple interfaces defined from your Z-Series box, it will allow you to learn to actually test multiple interfaces and verify that they're all being used. You can learn things like round-trip connectivity, and certainly if there's a problem, you can learn at which point in the network that problem is. So if we proceed to the next foil, foil 30, we see an example of this. The command, as you see at the top, is EE-DIAG, test equal yes, and then you could specify the two endpoints of the connection, either via IP addresses or host names. And then looking below at the output, you see some basic stuff echoed back to you. You see the IP addresses, which may or may not have been resolved, depending on how you specify the inputs. And then you see the actual test flow results after the flow. Test flow has occurred through the network. And in this case, I have a fairly simple scenario. I had two interfaces defined, and I was directly connected from that interface to the box on the other side, so everything's only one hop. But you can at least see the principle. If you look just at this on the bottom of page 30, at this first part of the test, we see an interface test. We then see connectivity successful five times. Why five times? Because we're testing all five EE ports. It's not unusual at all to have a problem where you're bringing up an EE connection with a business partner, you're traversing a firewall that's normally closed to UDP. You knew that, so you told the WAN engineering guys to go in and open all five ports, and they opened the four ports only. If you have one port open, that can be a difficult problem to diagnose. Well, here's a way you'll find it, because you would see connectivity successful in that case on four ports instead of all five. So we see the connectivity is successful, we see the IP address, we see the round trip times, and if we move to the next foil, we basically see the second half of that where we're testing the second interface. So this gives us a great way to test our ability to get to the other side. If this command succeeds, then our connection activation should proceed as well. You can also specify an existing connection, use this just to test that connection to learn about the round trip times, and this can help in determining performance issues, such as maybe if there's a problem between two hops along the way, and you could see a great difference in the round trip times associated with those two hops. It could help diagnose a problem along those lines. Proceeding to 4032, we're going to talk about EE connection network reachability awareness. And as you'll see there, this was a function that we introduced in V1R6. So I'm very briefly going to review that concept before I talk about what happened to it in V1R8. This was a very powerful function. As popular as EE has been, EE connection network has been a little slower to take off. And one of the reasons for that could have been the problem that underlies the scenario described on this diagram. The problem is essentially this. With EE connection network, the topology component inside ZOS is not notified when there is a dial failure, a connection attempt, a failure across a connection network. Because of that, he will continue to select that path until the connection network is completely deactivated. So in my picture here, my example, I show that NN1 successfully connects to NN2 across this connection network known as VRN1. However, when NN1 then tries to connect to NN3, that same connection attempt fails. Now, why is that? This VRN, remember, represents an entire IP cloud. There's probably lots of different routers, switches, firewalls, and other devices within that cloud. Certainly, a localized failure, such as the failure of a box near NN3, again, maybe it's a scenario where there's a firewall port not opened on a box near NN3 is causing a failure attempt only in that direction. So because of that, what we like to have happen is be able to route around that if there's an alternate route. Prior to this function described here, that was not possible. The routing component would continue to think VRN1 was the best route and continue to select it. Beginning in V1R6, if you enable connection network reachability awareness through the unreached time start option in VTAM, what you're basically saying is when a dial failure occurs, you want the topology component to remember that. And if you look at the little picture of the topology database at the bottom of this foil, you should see us remembering that NN1 tried to get to NN3 across VRN1 and it failed. And we're going to remember that for a fixed amount of time, and you determine that time. In my diagram here, I've said it's 60 seconds. Again, that is configurable. We'll remember it, and during that period of time, we will try to find an alternate route and not route across the connection network to that specified partner. Furthermore, this knowledge is then sent out via topology database updates to other network nodes so that they also can benefit from this same type of knowledge. Now, proceeding to foil 33, V1R8, we basically did a substantial rewrite of the underneathing of this function. Now, for a great degree, that wouldn't be of interest to customers. It helps us service it. It helps us develop it because the code is cleaner. But the reason there is customer benefit here is because in doing this, it makes things a little more logical to understand it, as far as how the unreachability records are structured, and therefore a little more obvious how to use display commands to look at the outstanding reachability information and clear it up as well, because we do provide now a full suite of display commands and modify commands, where the modify commands allow you the ability to clean up unreachable records. If you have a situation where we have failures noted across the connection network, you know those failures are no longer relevant, the hardware's been fixed or whatever the case may be, you can issue a modify command to free all those unreachability records and start off with a clean database again. So beginning in 1.8, you have a much fuller suite of display and modify commands to operate on the unreachability information. Proceeding to 4.34, we're going to say a few words about AnyNet. Now, several years ago, when the networking hardware division of IBM announced the withdrawal from marketing of the 3745, customers began to make hard looks at how they were going to migrate traditional SNA legacy hardware to more of an IP-type infrastructure. And there are many mechanisms for SNA modernizations. Enterprise Extender is one we just discussed, and that's a very good one. But there are other techniques like TN3270 and so forth. One technique that has been around for many years is AnyNet, and that has been provided on ZOS communication server for quite a long time. However, AnyNet usage was never that high, and it sharply declined over the years, and only began to be increase a little bit once again when people started thinking about how to handle the 3745 withdrawal. At this point in time, we would like to very strongly encourage you not to go to AnyNet. AnyNet is a legacy software protocol. Basically, you're talking about the replacement of a legacy hardware device with a legacy software protocol. AnyNet is far inferior to Enterprise Extenders from a functional perspective as far as what you can accomplish with it. In general, it also performs much more poorly than Enterprise Extender. And on this page, we have a graph that compares, this goes all the way back to V1R4, but it compares AnyNet to EE performance, both throughput as well as cost per transaction from a CPU perspective. And you can look at the numbers there, but what you will notice is they're very striking. Very, very sharp difference in both throughput and CPU consumption. Based on this, based upon the declining usage, the functional inferiority, as well as the more expensive costs associated with AnyNet, we made a decision and issued a statement of direction some time back saying that we would be pulling AnyNet out of communication server. That is now complete. V1R8 does not have AnyNet any longer. It is no longer included as part of communication server. So if you're moving to 1.8 and you still have some AnyNet within your network coming into ZOS communication server, you will have to transition to an alternate technology such as Enterprise Extender.
Okay, we'll continue to look at this set of SB108 communication server, and the next topic we'll look at is FTP and Telnet on the platform. So if you start at page 36 in your PDF files, looking at what we call the FTP client programming interface in REX. In ZOS V1R6, we began giving you a programming interface that allowed you to write programs that basically could start the FTP client and issue commands like signing onto an FTP server and get and put commands and whatever at the individual FTP client subcommand level. In V1.6, we provided that interface to you as a callable programming interface you could use from Assembler, COBOL, or PL1, or for that matter, any high-level language programming environment. In V1.7, we extended that with a C library interface, which then allowed you to use it from a C program. But where most of you probably wanted to go would be a Rex environment, and that is what we provide here in V1.8. So in V1.8, you can now write a Rex program running in TSO or in a batch address space, the batch TMP, for example, and have such a Rex program control an FTP client session with an FTP server somewhere in the network. It's a very simple programming interface that allows you to both synchronous and asynchronous commands. Especially asynchronous can be of interest when you are transferring large files that may take a certain amount of time. You can come back to your application program, and your application program can then pull and try and find out how many bytes have been transferred so far. And if you wanted to, you could, for that matter, maintain a little progress bar on an ISPF panel or something like that if you wanted to be that advanced. On page 37, one of the things we also added in this release was a better management capability of FTP. And by management in this context, we really mean monitoring. One of the issues that some of our customers were reporting to us was that when they used FTP to a large extent, it was somewhat difficult to maintain a good view into which FTP sessions are currently running, what transfers are going on right now, which transfers failed within the last 5 minutes, and things like that. So in ZOS V1.8, we add some functions to our network management interface that will report FTP-specific events over that interface. One example, on this example here, we're talking about both the ZOS FTP server and the ZOS FTP client running on ZOS. When an FTP session starts, when a transfer starts, when a transfer ends, and when the session ends again, we will invoke this NMI interface with those events. It's important to emphasize that this interface will work for both the FTP server and the FTP client. So whatever FTP batch jobs you're running during your production cycle will also be recorded through this interface. So it should be possible to have a complete picture of what goes on from an FTP activity point of view at any point in time. Page 38 is a brief addition to FTP to better support transfer UTF-8 encoded data sets in and out of MVS or of your ZOS system. The issue with UTF-8 data is that it is a strange mix from an FTP processing point of view between a binary transfer and a text transfer. From a data contents point of view, it's binary. From a end-of-line processing point of view, it is text data. So we added some specific support in this release to handle UTF-8 transfer in and out of your ZOS FTP system. And there were some specific components that needed that. We still need to fully support Unicode by the FTP server, and there are some more enhancements planned within this area. On page 39, just a brief review of a function that was implemented in ZOS V1.5, which was a Telnet server, or TN3270 server to be specific, response time monitoring capability. The TN3270 server can, and since V1.5, be configured to monitor round-trip times for individual TN3270 transactions, and it can split that round-trip time up into the IP time and the SNA time. With the SNA time, obviously, will include whatever elapsed time the transaction in CICS or whatever the SNA session primary or whatever the primary LU resides, how much time that takes, obviously, also. Originally, the way we provided access to the response time data was via SNMP, Network Management Protocol, Simple Network Management Protocol, requests to go and retrieve certain MIP variables, or you could do it through an MVS console display telnet server command. That was the only two ways we provided the data. And that really wasn't sufficient for many of the purposes that you wanted to use this response time data. So in ZOS v108, we add two new mechanisms to access the response time data that is collected by the TN370 server. One way is through, again, a network management interface where a network management application or product of some sort can retrieve the response time data interactively. And another way is to include it in the TN370 server SMF records, which the telnet server will write depending on your configuration options. You can configure the telnet server to write SMF records. And if you do that, we will now include the response time data for each individual SNA session that was established between the TN370 server and a primary LU within your network. On page 40 is just a simple example of how Omega Mont XE for mainframe networks exploit that new NMI interface to retrieve the TN370 server response time data and provide various forms of graphical views of that data. Other network management products will be able to do the same. It's not exclusive to Omega Mont, obviously. On page 41, there's a brief overview of a couple of additional TN370 server enhancements that are implemented in this release. One area that we have been working on quite a bit of time has been to deal with what we call TN270 connection reconnections, basically where a client thinks he or she lost a connection to the telnet server, but in fact it was just a temporary network hiccup, if you will. But the end user was not really patient and killed the emulator session, started a new emulator session, and managed now to get through to the network. Well, the telnet server really did not know that that previous connection no longer existed, because for a little period of time there was no connectivity through the network. So it never received any TCP segment termination packets to basically close that connection down. So when that connection comes into the telnet server again, there are all kinds of issues related to that. One is, for example, if the end user was originally logged on to TSO. Well, since the telnet server doesn't know that the original connection no longer is there, it still has an SNA session up and running with TSO, and the user is still logged on to TSO. So when the user manages to connect back in again and tries to get to TSO, he gets the usual messaging, you know, user ID is already in use and you cannot log on to TSO, and all the hassle associated with that. The various solutions we have provided so far worked quite well if there were one connection, if there was one connection between the end user workstation IP address and the TN3270 server. As soon as the end user had multiple emulator windows up and running and had multiple connections from the same source IP address and into the TN3270 server, there was no mechanism by which we were able to determine that, oh, by the way, this is really a reconnect and we may have some old connections we need to go and clean up. In v108, we add some enhanced capabilities in that area that is referred to as check client connections. And that capability will allow you to clean up old connections, even in the scenarios where the same source IP address, the same workstation, maintains multiple emulator sessions at the same point in time. Now that function is implemented in the what we call the standalone TN3270 server only. As you may recall from V1R6, we began giving you the option of starting a telnet server outside the TCP/IP system address space. We call that the standalone telnet server. And this function here is an example of new functions we have chosen to only implement in the standalone telnet server. So if you are running the telnet server within the TCP/IP system address space, we kind of recommend that you migrate to the standalone version. And especially if you need to use this type of function here, you have to move to the standalone version. A couple of other things we do in this release for the telnet server is that we add support within the USS message table, the log on screen that is presented by the telnet server. so that you can specify MVS system symbolics within that USS message. So it would actually be possible now to have a single USS message table definition for the Telnet server used by multiple LPAs, and then have system symbolics to display, you know, what is the LPA name that you managed to connect to, if that would be part of the information you wanted to display on that panel. The LU name exit routine is a mechanism we've had for a couple of releases that allows someone to actually write an exit routine to determine which LU name to use for a new connection that came into the TN70 server. It's a long range of configuration statements to determine that and select an LU name. And there were a few scenarios where those options were not sufficient, so we did provide an exit routine at some point in time. Initially, that exit routine allowed the allowed specification or selection of the LU name only. What we did in this release is we added the capability for the exit routine to also be able to determine which USS table and which interpret table should be used for this new connection into the Telnet server. And there are a couple of old statements that we have said for a while we would remove support for, and finally in V108 we did remove support for those, so those will actually now generate error messages if you see some of those, and if the Telnet server meets some of those in its configuration file.
Okay, now let's talk about a little bit about ZOS Health Checker. The Health Checker has been around now for some period of time, and by all reports has been fairly popular with our customers. What Health Checker does is give you a tool to help you determine if your installation is meeting best practice recommendations. Now, ComServer had so far, prior to 1.8, not had any support in this area yet, but 1.8 is sort of our initial foray into the Health Checker arena. We've implemented our basic infrastructure and our first few probes. And if you look down through there, you can see a list of the probes defined on here on FOIL 43. There's several that are around buffer sizes or CSM sizes. There's one related to the options you have enabled with CTrace. And in any event, what's happening is the probe is checking to see if you are within recommended ranges for the particular values we're checking. And if not, we'll spit out a message. It basically asks you to go take a look at some form of documentation, one of our books or maybe something like a tech note, to give you advice on how to properly configure that option. So this is something I think you'll see is enhanced more in the future. 1.8 sort of just provides an initial start from the ComServer perspective. Now moving on to 4.44, we'll talk a little bit about some various network management enhancements. And Alfred got us started a few foils back when he mentioned the network management interface for TN3270. We also have an enhancement in V108 for the Enterprise Extender Network Management Interface. And as you see here, it's a list of support wildcard names on the CP name filter. The gist of all that is that it's basically providing a network monitoring tool, a more efficient way to gather information about HPR pipes going to a given SNA net ID. So the idea here is that you would be monitoring your EE network and you'd like to know a little more about performance to a given business partner over, say, an extended border node type of connection. Your network monitoring tool today, if you have one that uses our NMI, probably provides that capability. This would just provide a more efficient way for the tool vendor to retrieve it and have it perform a little better. The next item on here is about connection termination reason codes. Now, for a long time, we've provided the ability to cut TCP connection termination records to SMF. But for quite some time, we have had a number of network management vendors point out to us that while we cut the records, we do not, with that, cut the reason code as to why the TCP connection is being terminated. There are over 30 different reasons why a TCP connection might be terminated, everything from normal termination to client reset to various forms of timeout. So it makes a lot of sense to do this, and finally in V108, we are including the reason code with the SMF record. One other item in the network management arena is we provided an NMI interface to drop socket endpoints. Now, this originated as a customer requirement to provide a similar capability with netstat, to basically allow wildcarding to issue a single netstat command that would drop all connections associated with, say, a given IP address. Well, this sounded nice on the surface, but we were afraid it was a little too much power, that would give you the capability to drop thousands of connections with one command issuance, and that people would inadvertently lose lots of connections and be quite upset. So instead, what we've done is we provided the capability through an NMI that could be driven by a fairly simple network management application. network management application, which would probably have the capability to look at what you've asked for, come up and say, okay, this will cause the dropping of 50,000 connections. Is that really what you want to do? ZOS does not normally get into the game of are you sure messages like you get with Windows, but a network management can provide confirmation dialogues that would be more useful. So this NMI would provide such an application, a way to do this. Moving on to 4L45, I'm going to talk about better tracking of DVIPA creation and deletion. And so one thing we do in V1R8 is we have new NVS console messages which give you details on when application-specific DVIPAs are created or deleted. The messages tell you which job name caused the creation or deletion of the DVIPA and also why. So was an ioctl issued, a bind, a close? You get that through this type of message here. Also, we've enhanced the netstat VIPA dyn report to show the activation time and the job name associated with the DVIPA. 446 takes us to the netstat enhancements for this release. Every release, it seems like we have a few netstat enhancements, and V1R8 is no different in that regard. You can look down through these. They're fairly simple, but hopefully powerful. There is a new modifier called server, which allows you to retrieve all connections in listening state. We've added auto log information to the netstat config report, and we now have a new filter on the connection-oriented netstat reports, which allows you to specify IP address plus port as a single unit. So a single filter with the syntax actually shown here on the foil, and you can do this on netstat all con sockets, telnet, any of the connection-oriented netstat reports. Moving to 4047, we see some commentary about some retired TCP/IP profile parameters. The assorted PARMs and keep alive option statements in the TCP/IP profile have been removed from V1R8. Now, this should not be a significant impact because we've been warning of this for quite a long time. Beginning in V1R2 of ZOS, we started issuing warning messages when we detected these statements and let you know that they were going to be deprecated in the future. They've long been equivalent parameters in place, and so we've been urging you to migrate. Now, beginning 1.8, you actually have to do that migration because these have been eliminated. Proceeding to 4.48, this is entitled Linux Message Integration. The idea here is to allow Syslog Daemon to receive Syslog's messages from the Z-Series Linux systems over the UDP network and then write these messages to a new destination, the ZOS Opera Log. Now, prior to V1R8, you can only have one syslog daemon, but now beginning in V1R8, you can actually have two, one to monitor network activity and one to monitor internal activity. You still can run one and you take both sets of activities and it'll be merged together, or you can run the two daemons independently. Anyway, in either case, what this is doing is helping us to build a bridge and have better integration between ZOS and Z-Series or System Z9 Linux. And lastly, if you'll skip over the next subtitle 4 and move to 4.50, we have a couple of statements of direction to discuss. First of all, Alfred mentioned earlier the standalone telnet server option we've had since V1R6. We implemented that in V1R6. It gave you the capability to run telnet in its own address space outside of the stack address space. This provided a number of benefits, serviceability benefits, integrity benefits, and maybe most importantly, it gave you the capability of running the telnet server at a different priority than the TCP/IP stack itself. Migrating from the in-stack version to the standalone version, very straightforward, and many of our customers that were waiting on this function did it almost immediately upon moving to V1R6. So we've been encouraging for some time people to take this step, even to the point of pointing out that we could not really afford to maintain both indefinitely because it's an issue of maintaining dual code paths. As pointed out earlier, we have a new function in V1R8 that we introduced for Telnet that we did not even support for the in-stack version. So we've been foreshadowing a long time. Here now is a statement of direction that says that after V1R8, you will no longer be able to run TN3270 as part of the TCP/IP stack address space. It must be separate. So now when you go to V1R8, or as soon as you can, begin using this as an opportunity to go ahead and migrate to the standalone server. You do get some benefits from it. There's virtually no downside. And I can tell you this statement of direction really has already been fulfilled because we have previewed V1R9. V1R9, one of the items in there is the removal of support for the InStack Telnet server. So V108 is indeed the last release in which you can do this. One more statement of direction to discuss, and I want to be very careful with this one that no one gets misled by what this is saying. This talks about the removal of the APPC application suite after V1R8. And the APPC application suite has been around a very long time. What it is a set of small APPC-based programs that were introduced back in the early days of APPN on the mainframe to show how APPN in a peer-to-peer network environment works and to provide some benefit to the customers. There was an AFTP function, an A3270, an ANAME, and an APing. Many folks have not heard of this suite because they have never used it. It was on the tape, but you had to install it separately. It did not get a lot of use, except maybe for APing. However, APing was so powerful that we decided to integrate it as a separate VTAM command many, many VTAM releases ago back in the mid-90s. So the one piece of the A suite that was getting used a lot, we basically took away the need to have it in A suite. Since then, there's been so little use of that we've decided that we are no longer going to supply it with ComServe anymore. After 1.8, it will no longer be supplied on the tape, and we do not believe this should be a significant impact to anyone. But the most important thing I would encourage you to notice about this, if you look down into here, note that this is explaining APPC itself, the API, remains an integral part of VTAM, so please do not be confused. What we are talking about here is the removal of the APPC application suite, a set of four very small, very focused programs only. The APPC API is still supported, is still very integral to VTAM and SNA, and there is nothing implied by this SOD as far as the future of that API. It's only the application suite that is going to be withdrawn. And with that, we come to the conclusion of our V1R8 overview. You will see on the following few foils, 52 and 53, sort of a summary of the items within the V1R8 release. And lastly, on foil 54, some hopefully useful references. And with that, we will wrap up and conclude this presentation.